This is Brannon House Live. Whether the issue is law, science, economics, history, family, social issues, education, religion, government, or national security, Brannon brings the issues of the day into clear focus through the lens of a Judeo-Christian worldview. And now, here is your host, Brannon House.
Good evening and welcome to Brannon House Live on Lindell TV, streaming on the frankspeech.com platform. We're going to be joined tonight, I think we're going to be joined by Dr. Shiva. We had him on my radio show today for an hour. We're going to try to get him on for a few minutes a little bit later for an update on his federal lawsuit on censorship. And by the way, guess what he found out today? In his lawsuit on censorship, they're censoring his lawsuit. He did a filing, and they're censoring his filing, and his lawsuit is on censorship. What is the irony? We're going to be joined also with a live presentation from Dallas, Texas, by Mike Lindell tonight. Mike Lindell speaking live in Dallas at America's Revival Rally. They're expecting thousands there tonight, and we'll be bringing it to you live from Dallas, Texas. My first guest, however, has gone viral several times now. Her name is Karen Kingston. She founded Virage. Excuse me. Phonics doesn't always work. I need to go to treatment because I'm hooked on phonics, but it doesn't always work. To create an innovative agency for the biotech and pharmaceutical industries. And she spent 20 years in the industry. Her experience goes across sales, marketing, strategic consulting, digital media, and senior management. She was a top performing sales representative in New York City for Pfizer. You guys recognize that name? Pfizer. Well, she could talk for hours, and she sent me a lot of detailed PowerPoint slides and graphics. We'll go through a little bit of them. Again, we can have her here for hours, but we are very pleased that she's been able to make time for us because she's in great demand. And after we have her as a guest, you'll know why. Karen, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Brannon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and we're just really glad to have you on with us. And the PowerPoint slides you sent that we can go through are amazing. Tell our audience, before we start going through those, a little bit about yourself in addition to what I just laid out.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to give a little bit about my background. First, I want to clarify that I am not a whistleblower. I forwarded you that email I got from Reuters, and I will be responding to them. So I do have 25 years experience in the industry, but a whistleblower is a very specific term. It means that someone is currently employed by the company that they are disclosing confidential information on, so they signed an NDA, or they're under contract with them as a consultant or an analyst, and they signed an NDA. So they're putting forth information that is confidential, and that's what a whistleblower is. I think the mafia calls them a rat. So I'm not a rat. I'm not a whistleblower. Everything that I'm disclosing to you is public information. For the record, I did start off as a drug rep in Manhattan. I was top performing. I got to work with people in headquarters. I was quickly recruited to the marketing and advertising side. And when I moved out to California, I started a consulting and analyst agency and did a lot of business analysts. And it's done very well over the years. But that's basically my background. And I do want to address another thing that Reuters sent me. They asked to fact check, and we're not going to go into a lot of detail, the graphene oxide. They reached out to Cinepeg. And Cinepeg, if you've seen any of my other podcasts, is the company that is manufacturing the pegylated lipid nanoparticles. PEG stands for polyethylene glycol. And so what's interesting is Cinepeg's located in China, and they didn't deny the fact that they're making the pegylated lipid nanoparticles for over all the COVID-19 vaccines. They just denied that it doesn't have graphene oxide in it. And let's also remember that back when Trump was president and he called this the Wuhan virus, that Xi Jinping out of the Wuhan lab said, no, we did not make this virus. That's not true. So I would take a grain of salt with anything from any organization or company in China is denying, but I love the fact that they're not denying that they're making the pegylated lipid nanoparticles for the COVID-19 excipients for the vaccines. And a couple questions I have for them is, Are they providing these to companies such as AGC Biologics, who I believe is the number one manufacturer for Pfizer and BioNTech globally? They have facilities in Tokyo and Seattle and Heidelberg, Germany. So is that where they're supplying these, pegylated lipid nanoparticles? Are they giving to Fosun China? Fosun Pharma, who's also in China, and they are also manufacturing the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine. So I would love to ask some questions to Reuters back to Cinepeg myself. So wow. Just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to your slides. Your first one here is, and again, we can kind of go through, you call on them and the numbers you want to go in and we'll grab them from our control room and go to them. But why are fully vaccinated Americans being hospitalized? This is what we want to talk with her a little bit about tonight. Why are fully vaccinated Americans being hospitalized? Because we had on Dr. Zev Zelenko last night. He was quoting one guy, a former VP with Pfizer, stating that he thinks that there could be 75% of the vaccinated dead within 3 years, particularly if they don't do something in regards to fighting off future infection that Dr. Zev Zelenko describes as being kind of a trigger. Then we have Dr. Robert Malone. CDC noticed that those vaccinated have higher rates of virus than those not vaccinated. And then, of course, Zev Zelenko went on to talk about the antibody-dependent enhancement and the threat of all these things. So when we talk about people that are vaccinating being hospitalized, this is totally against the narrative in the media, is it not?
It is. And those three facts that you just bulleted off are very disheartening, very alarming. The sooner that Americans realize that these injections were meant to do nothing but poison, harm, and induce mortality, the sooner we can start providing solutions to help heal Americans, physically as well as heal as a country. So I want to be clear about that. But what I wanted to talk about today is that the CDC just this week put out their weekly morbidity and mortality weekly report. They've been doing this since the 80s. And the case study, if you go to the second slide, this is a case study out of a town in Massachusetts. And what they found was 469 patients who tested positive for COVID. They call it COVID-19, but I assume SARS-CoV-2. 74% of them were vaccinated. And by fully vaccinated, they defined fully vaccinated as having gotten two of the Pfizer BioNTech shots or one J&J shot, and it's 14 days after that second shot. So they're fully vaccinated, and per the CDC, they've had 2 weeks to produce monoclonal antibodies, okay? So why are they getting sick? And then what's even more alarming, if you go to the next slide, I just did this in pie charts so that people could visually see this data. So of those who are being vaccinated, that's in the blue group, 74% out of nearly 500 in this one town in Boston, Massachusetts, tested positive for COVID-19. Then 80% of those that ended up being hospitalized were fully vaccinated. Mm. And then if you go on to the next slide, which I believe is slide 4,
yes,
those who presented symptoms out of the 346 who were fully vaccinated, so there's 346 of these people who were fully vaccinated that tested positive, almost 80% of them presented symptoms as well of having COVID-19. And then the CDC's conclusions and recommendations are clearly reckless. They say, based on this evidence, which is that those who are fully vaccinated, 74% are going to test positive, 80% of people who are hospitalized are fully vaccinated, and they're going to present symptoms. They're saying what we recommend is that we test more people, that we have them wear masks, that we have them social distance, that we know that the Delta variant is highly transmissible. 89% of these people tested positive for the alleged Delta variant. And they also say the number one thing we can do is vaccinate more people to prevent serious illness and death. Well, anyone with a sixth grade level education would say, hey, if you did a study, and in that study, 75% of people got sick who were vaccinated, so 25% didn't get sick who were unvaccinated, and those who end up in the hospital, 80% were vaccinated that ended up in the hospital,
wow.
20% who weren't vaccinated didn't end up in the hospital. I would say the conclusion is don't vaccinate people.
Right.
Vaccinate people gets them sick, makes them symptomatic. infects other people and makes them end up in the hospital. This is doublespeak out of Orwell's 1984.
Absolutely.
It doesn't make any sense. So I don't know what your thoughts are on this.
No, I'm in 100% agreement, and it's consistent with what we've been hearing from medical experts since early 2020, who actually predicted that this would happen, that there would be more people getting sick from, not from infection, but from injection. We had on Dr. Judy Mikovich talking about this in early 2020. Then, of course, we've interviewed numerous times Dr. Peter McCullough. He's talking about all the vaccine-injured patients he's receiving. He also thinks that this is causing more people to be sick. And he's also, of course, gone into great detail on how you could cure these people, you know, for just a few dollars, you know, hydrochloroquine, zinc, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you have to wonder, again, what is the objective? What is the goal? Again, you can agree to disagree, but we did a show in early 2020. We started looking at all the players. Bill Gates, who's bragged that his vaccine can decrease the population. His father, of course, was a big proponent into Planned Parenthood. We see the Gates involved with a lot of population control, Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, UN stuff. We see that Johns Hopkins, one of the big four founders of Johns Hopkins, was into eugenics. We see that the head of WHO, Tedros, he comes from the London University. That has a huge, huge background with one of the founders of eugenics. So, I mean, when you start looking at the players, I start to have to ask the question, is this on purpose because some of them are committed to eugenics? That's my opinion. I don't expect you to agree with it.
Brandon, that's not an opinion. I think, you know, people say if you want to know someone's intentions, look at the outcomes.
Right.
So the outcomes of people being injected with these alleged vaccines are they're getting sick and hospitalized and dying, and they're infecting others. And let's take a look at the FDA filings. Let's go into that a little bit, because if you take a look at what they actually filed with the FDA, they never proved they prevented infection. As a matter of fact, more people in the Pfizer study group who were vaccinated came down with COVID-19 symptoms than those in the placebo group. So if you go to slide 6, I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about this, but if you can, so a lot of people think 95% efficacy, 100% efficacy means that out of 100 people, if I was vaccinated, that means 95 out of 100 won't get sick with a, you know, confidence interval of 95% or a p-value of 0.01%. But that's not true. There's a New York Times article right here, what does 95% efficacy mean, teaching the math of vaccine efficacy, and it's from, what's the date? Anyway, you can look it up. I don't have the date. I have June 30th. That's probably when I had printed it out. So they ran different numbers, but what they figured out in the IND, the initial new drug application, which they submitted to the FDA before they started the phase 3 trial, was that if they had 44,000 participants, 22,000 in the placebo, 22,000 in the vaccine group, over a period of 6 months with an infection rate of 1.3% per year. So think about that, too. They knew the infection rate is so low. They were projecting the infection rate to be 1.3% per year. We shouldn't even be vaccinating for an infectious disease that is that non-infectious. So they were saying within 6 months, we would get about 164, 168 people in the placebo group who got sick, and that would prove our 95% efficacy. Mm. Well, they start doing the studies, and you go to slide 7, and lo and behold, they decide to test the placebo and the treatment group 1 week after the second dose. So it takes 2 weeks to produce antibodies after the second dose, but they do it 1 week after the second dose, and I'll explain why in a minute. But here you can see in the placebo group, it's 169 people tested positive with their PCR, their bogus PCR test, and 9 tested positive with their bogus PCR test in the vaccine group. And from that, they said, look, the 95% efficacy, what that means is that 1 week after you get your second dose of the Pfizer shot, you have a 95% chance of having a 1% reduction in risk of getting infected. Let that sink in. The 95% efficacy is a 95% effective in reducing your risk of infection by 1%.
Wow.
That's how they define vaccine efficacy. But what's even
more... Make sure I understand that. Did you just say that the chances of not getting the virus if you get vaccinated is 1%?
if you get vaccinated, you reduce your risk by getting infected by 1%.
Okay, so you reduce your risk by 1%.
By 1%. Based on bogus math.
But we've already... that's based on bogus math?
That's based on bogus math, because if you go to the next slide, what you'll see, these are people that didn't have a chance to get tested.
Right.
In the placebo group, there were 287 patients 1 week after they all got their second shot. The placebo group got their second shot of saline solution. So 287 didn't get tested, but they had COVID-19 symptoms. In the Pfizer group, they got their second shot of the Pfizer vaccine. 409 tested or presented with COVID-19 symptoms, but gosh darn it, they didn't have enough time to test these people in the 2-year safety and efficacy study.
Right.
So what you're looking at here truly is that there's either no difference 1 week after being injected with regards to preventing infection, or the vaccine group causes more infection than the placebo group.
And so that brings us to vaccine efficacy, or the
efficacy.
In other words, the benefits. That means the benefits, right?
The efficacy means prevention of infection. Now, here's the question I have.
But the red is 0%.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's actually probably negative. It's probably what this is. It's probably 10% increased risk, because when you inject someone with the recombinant mRNA, the program to produce the spike protein, and the spike protein is what we know is highly deadly and causes symptoms, including severe morbidity and oftentimes mortality. So if you're injecting people with the code to produce the spike protein as the vaccine, it would make sense that more people that are injected with the code to produce the spike protein would get sick versus those people who did nothing at all and are not exposing themselves to the spike protein.
Wow. Wow.
It's kind of common sense. And if you think that's, doesn't, add up, just take a look at the VAERS data, and this is from July 23rd, and we have nearly 12,000 deaths so far reported. But what's important to point out about the VAERS data, let me just see if I have this readily available, is that we know it's really only about 1% of the full cases that have been reported, based on a study that was done out of Harvard, and I have it here somewhere.
And we've heard that same thing, that the VAERS is only about 1% reporting. So that's pretty standard.
I would explain it to people if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So this is the study out of Harvard. The lead investigator was Ross Lazarus. It's conducted between December 1st of 9:30. December 1st, 2007, and September 30th, 2010. I've been looking at a lot of European reports too, so I'm getting my dates.
Yeah, because they do their dating differently. How they
date different. So basically, this is December 2007 through September 30th, 2010. So about a 2.5-year study. And what this was a study of, I'm just going to read it to you verbatim, and everyone can look this up, because I want you to understand the validity and the integrity of the data and the information that not only I, but many other people are sharing with you. So June 2006 through October 2009, 715,000 patients received 1.4 million doses of 45 different vaccines. Of these doses, there were about 36,000 possible reactions. This is an average of about 890 possible events, or an average of 1.3 events per clinician per month. Now, what they go on to say is they were looking at what was reported into VAERS, and they say the vaccine side effects are often underreported. So this is actually a vaccine reporting tracking study into VAERS done by Harvard. And they said 25% of ambulatory patients experience an adverse drug event, and less than 0.3% of drug events, or 1 to 13%, are reported to the FDA. Now, that's not the vaccine. They go on to say that fewer than 1% of the vaccine adverse events are reported. And they say this is a major problem. So this 11,000 number is is basically only 1% of the reported events. And then recently, Fulmich, the attorney Reinrich Fulmich out of Germany, was saying that a whistleblower from the CDC said they actually have 45,000 deaths on file at VAERS, but they covered up those numbers. So we're easily looking at 500,000 to upwards of millions of people who have died from this vaccine already, if not going to in the near future.
How many?
500,000 is what Reiner Fulmich estimates, because there's 45,000, according to a whistleblower at the CDC, that have recorded 45,000 deaths. But again, best case scenario, that's only 10% of the actual incidences, and worst case scenario, that's 1%. So we could be looking at 500,000, or we could be looking at upwards of 1 or 2 million at this point in time.
Wow. All right, so we're on slide 8. Do we need to keep moving?
I think there's slide 10. So I would go to slide 11.
Okay.
So people are shocked.
Oh, wait a minute. You were just on slide 10? Is that what you were just on?
I was just showing the VAERS. Yeah, I was showing the VAERS data.
Okay,
that's the current VAERS
data. So let me have them look at that for just a few minutes. The death. Okay, and that's from the 7/23/21 release of VAERS. Okay, found 518,770 cases with the vaccine. Okay, and then we see the death, permanent disability. Okay, so wow.
But that number, according to a CDC whistleblower, the 12,000 deaths or 11,940 is actually 45,000, and it's probably more like 450,000 or upwards of 1 million to 2 million it could be.
At this point.
At this point, and or what's going to occur in the near future.
Wow. Okay, now I'm on 10. I was 10. Now I'm on 11.
So, you know, again, people could say, well, this is just another person opining that's not an expert. Well, this is the FDA's opinion on what could happen with the vaccines when they had a meeting on October 22nd, 2020 with their vaccine and related biological products advisory meeting. And what they said is, hey, we better be on the lookout for Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is paralysis, encephalomyelitis, which is inflammation, and transverse myelitis, so inflammation of both the brain as well as the spinal cord. They said you have to look out for convulsions and seizures, stroke, narcolepsy, anaphylaxis, which we were expecting anaphylaxis from these vaccines, specifically from the polyethylene glycol lipid nanoparticles, acute myocardial infarction, myocarditis and pericarditis. And what's so alarming about myocarditis and pericarditis in the children is that these are not mild. I don't care what Walensky has to say. You don't go to the hospital because your heart or the lining of your heart gets inflamed and it's a mild case.
Right.
So these children, unfortunately, are going to, honestly, best case scenario, have years or decades taken off their life. Worst case scenario, that this is an indication of a far more serious autoimmune disease. And then that's something that Judy Mikovits and other experts can speak to. And the sooner we can recognize this, the sooner we can get these children the proper treatment to turn around their health. They also talk about numerous autoimmune diseases that could come up. Death, is listed. Pregnancy and birth outcomes, stillbirth, birth defects, thrombocytopenia, which is basically wiping out of your platelets. They also talk about thrombosis, which is the blood clots and the strokes. Arthritis, Kawasaki disease, which is actually also known as the next bullet right underneath it, multi-inflammatory syndrome in children. Keep in mind that when SARS-CoV-2 came out, children did not get sick from this. Of the 300 children that were listed in the CDC database, they all had at least two or three comorbid conditions, and many of them were very advanced severe diseases, such as stage 4 cancer. Some of them unfortunately died from type 1 diabetes and went into a coma, but these were very sick children in general. And we were told to be wary, because if the spike protein gets into the children's system and it sneaks under their immune response, then they can get Kawasaki syndrome or multi-inflammatory syndrome. But the truth is, it never really could get past their nasopharynx part of their system. Children simply did not get infected with SARS-CoV-2, the spike protein did not get into their immune system, and it was of no risk. And now we're injecting it directly into their bodies, directly into their CD4 cells, into their T cells, and replicating it in their bodies. This is a terrible idea. The only intention of this idea is to harm and unfortunately kill children. There's no benefit to this. None.
So again, you would not keep doing this with the results we're getting unless this was the goal.
If you're looking for someone's intentions, like Carl Jung says this, if you're questioning what someone's intentions are and they say, hey, I'm here to help you, But all they're doing is lying, stealing, harming, beating, and killing you. Do you think they're here to help you?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
And we have to look at the outcomes,
so
not
now,
what.
Now we're on the slide 12. Tell me what 12 is.
So slide 12 is, again, so this is just more validation from the FDA saying, we don't think, we have no proof that these are effective, right? So ironically, I'm going to go back to Reuters because they decided to do a little dig on me. In April of this year, they said the vaccines are proven to be effective in preventing infection. And the FDA says right here, it's not, we don't even know if we can assess this past 2 months.
Wow.
They can't assess it past 2 weeks. If you take a look at the healthcare provider sheet, it says clearly in the healthcare provider sheet, you must let everyone know before you inject them that this does not prevent infection or spreading or risk of disease from SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. It says it right there in the healthcare provider sheets. It also says, and it says here, there's insufficient evidence to conclude any benefit to individuals with also prior SARS-CoV-2 infection. So if you've already been infected, they were saying, we can't say this does anything for you. And as Senator Rand Paul has said a number of times, that's true. And also, are you increasing them at risk? Because they already do have a robust immune response to this virus. And then they go on to talk about children, 16 to 17 years of age. This was prior to them authorizing 12 to 15-year-olds. But before they even did that, they said, hey, we don't know if there's any benefit to 16 to 17-year-olds. And out of the 44,000 patients that we studied in our clinical studies, there was only one case reported in the 16 to 17-year-old group that even got infected. So again, as I said earlier, as the experts have said earlier, as physicians around our country and around the globe have said, children are at zero risk for getting sick from this.
Yes.
Why are we injecting them?
Yeah, we've heard this from Dr. Judy Mikovits, certainly from Dr. Peter McCullough the other night, over and over and over the last couple times we've interviewed him. So many of the people we've interviewed are saying this that have medical backgrounds or MDs. Again, it's not possible to assess sustained, benefit over a period of longer than 2 years, and yet we've heard that if you actually get the COVID, you could have an immune up to 17
months.
Years.
Brandon, it's 2 months. You said 2 years.
I'm sorry, 2 months.
2 months.
2 months. Yeah. And yet, if you get the COVID, we've heard your immune system might be good for up to 17 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Most vaccines, we get our chicken. I had chicken pox. I didn't get a vaccine. Children get their chickenpox vaccine, it lasts for life. Measles, mumps, rubella, it lasts for life. You get a booster, it lasts for life.
Yeah.
For something
that may work for 2 months, but to get something that might benefit you for 2 months, yet we saw in the study earlier, what percentage of those that got in the study ended up in the hospital? Wasn't it 80%?
That wasn't a study. There was a case study. It was a case report. They just looked at a town in Massachusetts. Sorry, I call it a case study, which is different than a actual clinic scientific study.
Okay.
They just took 469 people from this town in Massachusetts, and they found that 74% of them who were fully vaccinated tested positive for the virus, and 79% presented with symptoms. And then 80% of people that were hospitalized, it was actually 4 out of 5 people that were hospitalized, 80% of those that were hospitalized were fully vaccinated. So being vaccinated, I wouldn't say, I think pretty inconclusively, it shows that it increases your risk for getting sick,
right?
Seriously sick, infecting others, and ending up in the hospital compared to doing nothing at all.
Wow.
Other than being healthy.
Now we're on to, I think, slide 13, right?
I do want to talk about this because I do want to drive this home in regards to what's been done to the children. So Rochelle Walensky, about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, was pushing for 12 to 17-year-olds to be vaccinated. And her logic was that if there's only 30 to 4, as she calls them, mild cases of myocarditis, there's no such thing as a case of mild myocarditis. Again, it is a serious, serious indication of heart damage. And does affect a child's functionality to play sports. It can take years or decades off their life, and it can be indicative of a far more serious autoimmune disease. But she's like, look, if we inject a million kids and 40 of them get myocarditis. Maybe it's a mild case. Maybe they die, because that also does happen.
But wait a minute, how does she even know that if we did a million kids, you'd have 30 to 40 cases? How do you know you wouldn't have 100,000, 200,000 cases?
This is based on their math. I don't trust their math, but this is according to the CDC math. And the CDC math is based on what they've seen in VAERS, so how many kids they saw in VAERS, 12 to 17-year-olds who had myocarditis, and then they ran that against the numbers of their database on how many children they had seen who had been vaccinated so far. And the number was basically 1 in 25,000. But we know that VAERS is underreported by at least 10%, so that's 1 in 2,500, and probably more likely 1 in 250. So that means a child would have more of a 4% chance of having myocarditis, heart inflammation, and potentially death if you inject them, versus a 1 in 2.5 million or 1 in 5 million chance of nothing happening to them if you did nothing.
Wow.
Oh. So I don't know where she learned math, but her analysis is reckless and unconscionable, and I don't understand how she continues to put this messaging forward and encourage parents, students, school boards to inject children and put their lives at risk and put their livelihood and just their ability to live life as they're meant to live it, as a healthy young child, teenager, and young adult. You know, the way God intended it for them to be, not to be injected with this gene therapy that's encapsulated with polyethylene glycol lipid nanoparticles, which are shown, I have another study, which are shown to cause massive inflammatory responses, including cytokines such as interleukin 1 beta, which induces carcinomas. It induces tumor growth for cancers. So, and we'll go on to that in the next slide. It's just, reckless isn't the word. It's unconscionable. It's evil. The depravity that's been brought onto us and the lies that have been told to American people in the globe has been done by people without conscience.
So now I'm on slide 14.
Okay. Do you have anything to say, Brandon? I'm sorry.
No, I mean, my audience is used to me doing long form interviews and letting the expert who's done the research present. I don't want to get in the way. If I don't understand something, I think the audience might, I'll jump in. This is so valuable. I know that other talk show hosts do 4 and 5 minute interviews, but that's not, we're known for long form and letting our guests talk. This is so valuable what you're doing for us. So keep going. I'm only jumping in if I think I need clarification.
Oh, please. Yeah. If you need clarification or if you have, again, follow-up questions,
yeah.
If you want more information. So, I probably should have started with this slide, but let's back up to say what's in these vaccines.
And yes.
So we know it contains recombinant mRNA. That stands for modified or synthetic ribonucleic acid, which is the code. It is the man-made code, like a computer code, to then produce the spike protein. Here's the problem with RNA, whether it's zoonic from animals, whether it's actual a human coronavirus, or whether it's man-made, and the researchers from the NIH and NIAID and Moderna all talk about this. mRNA or RNA is very unstable. It's a single helix protein. So what that means is that it can easily disintegrate. And the Trump administration brought light to this, I believe, last April. They did a press conference. I don't remember who spoke from the administration, but they were saying, look, great news. This virus is unstable. Sunlight kills it. So UVA sunlight kills the virus. 80-degree weather kills it. Basically, if the wind blows too strong, it kills it. The saliva, the enzymes in your saliva kill it. It's very hard for it to make it past the nasopharynx part of your system. And even the researchers from the NIH and from Moderna said, look, if you look at RNA wrong or even rRNA or synthetic RNA the wrong way, it disintegrates. So what do we need to do? We need to make a biosphere to protect it, so that we can get it into other people, into people's immune systems, so that it can then penetrate your immune cells, your CD4 cells, and then proliferate the spike protein. So that's exactly what they did. They made a biosphere to protect it. And that biosphere is made of 4 lipids. Lipids is the scientific term for fats in general. It doesn't mean fat exactly the way we think of it, but it's another term for fat. They love, they're hydrophilic, which means they love aqueous, you know, water-like substances like our blood. So the four lipids are cholesterol, and again, our blood loves cholesterol. So the mRNA is going to be encapsulated in cholesterol. It's going to be encapsulated in something called a phospholipid. The phospholipid allows for this little biosphere to then adhere to the cell membrane of other cells. And that creates like a permeable little entry for the mRNA to enter. But in order for it to do that, it needs a positive ionic charge. So a positive charge. So it has an ionizable lipid in it as well. And then lastly, in order to protect it and give it some armor, it has a pegylated lipid. And PEG, it's P-E-G, stands for polyethylene glycol. That is made by a company called Sinopeg in China. And that's who's made, and they have a whole portfolio called COVID-19 excipients. And excipient means vehicle or delivery system. So this company in China called Sinopeg is making the delivery system, the pegylated LNPs, for all mRNA vaccines globally, including the ones in the U.S. And I love the fact that Reuters called me out to fact check my credibility, my background, and saying that there's not graphene oxide in there because they contacted Sinopeg. And Sinopeg didn't deny that they're making the pegylated LNPs for all the COVID-19 vaccines. They're just saying, prove to us that it has graphene oxide in it. Wow. So my question to the American people and to the government and to the NIH and the FDA and the CDC is, do you think it's a good idea for a company in China called Sinopeg to be making the core biosphere structure that's needed to inject this synthetic mRNA into people through the vaccines? Like, this is the top manufacturer? Is that a good idea?
No, so you're saying one of the ingredients in the vaccine is manufactured in China.
The most important ingredient, read the headline from Chemical and Engineering News, which is interviews the guys from Moderna and NIH.
So it doesn't matter what vaccine you take, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, whatever.
No, Johnson & Johnson is not an mRNA vaccine.
Okay.
This is mRNA vaccine. And the headline, without these lipid shells, there would be no mRNA vaccines for COVID-19.
And which ones of the vaccines have that in it?
In the United States, that would be Moderna.
Okay.
And then Pfizer-BioNTech.
Okay. So if the ingredient that you're talking about is made in China that's in those vaccines, is there anything that they could do? Because again, I'm a layperson, so I'm going to ask the same question I think maybe the audience is asking. Is there anything they could do with that, making it in China, to harm us if we have it in our vaccine?
Absolutely. And if you go to slide 40, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Actually, go to slide 41 first.
Slide 41, all right.
Before you go to slide 41, go to slide 39. Sorry.
That's all right. Slide 39, I'm there.
So slide 39. So here's what's interesting is that if you read the Moderna patent, which is the Moderna NIH patent for mRNA lipid nanoparticle vaccines, it is the patent for every mRNA vaccine, including Pfizer and BioNTech. Okay.
Okay.
It's 193 pages long. They don't mention graphene oxide in it anywhere. So you're like, well, then what would make you think it has graphene oxide in it? Well, one, it says it on the Sinopeg site, but two, Bill Gates talked about there being a trade secret, which is why he didn't want to have every manufacturer manufacture his product. So trade secrets are not privy to the public purview, right? We don't know what a trade secret is. It's not in a patent because the patents are public. You can access them publicly. What's interesting is this company called Shanghai Nanotech, in January of this year, they filed a patent specifically for using graphene oxide in nanocoronavirus recombinant vaccines for COVID-19. So it's kind of ironic, but they kind of, you know, screwed over Moderna and NIH and said, we're going to make a little extra commission, if you will, or royalty, because we're going to file a patent for graphene oxide, because in China, we can do that. In the United States, you can't because it's a known lethal toxin, and they probably wouldn't allow for it. So they're making a little bit extra money. And oh, how ironic, they're also in China. And then this is an image from Shanghai Nanotech's website. And I don't know if that's Tail Zaks from Moderna, but it's his doppelganger.
Which one in the picture are you referring to? I'm going to kind of blow it up.
The man there with a suit on and he's got glasses. He's closest to the camera.
Yeah, right there. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. So that could be, you know, again, these, and then if you go to the World Health Organization, they do list a lot of these C-level executives from all these companies, including from Shanghai Nanotech, who are working together on the vaccine. So I think this is some more evidence that you could put something toxic such as graphene oxide into the vaccines. But if you go then onto slide 41, keep in mind that in 2016, December 2016, under President Obama, he, through the pandemic and all, I think actually this was under the CARES Act, which is the December 2016, what he allowed for is point B, the FDA to waive current good manufacturing practices, which include storage, handling, shipping, inspecting the facilities, also expiration dates. You could extend expiration dates. You can do that under emergency use authorization. And then if you go to slide 40, this is what I found most alarming. This is from pages 47 and 48 from the Pfizer-BioNTech phase 3 filing for approval of the vaccines. And this is the chemistry, manufacturing, and control information, the CGMP information, the good manufacturing information. It's redacted.
And that's slide 40. Which one do you want me on right now?
That's slide 40.
Okay,
this
here we
is
go.
Straight out of.
Okay, I've got it on the screen now. I had the wrong one. Sorry about that.
Pfizer binder. Yeah, I mean, this is the Pfizer phase 3. It's filed November 20th, 2020.
With all that
this
stuff redacted there.
They redacted the good manufacturing part. So they redacted information about where these are being manufactured, who's overseeing them, where it's coming from.
Why is that redacted? We have Gordon Chang we've had on. We've had on, of course, Dr. McCullough a couple times and other experts who are referring to this as, you know, a very concerning, obviously, problem that it, you know, came out of China, was developed in China. We've had on Dr. Lawrence Sullins with his source out of China saying it was released on purpose October 2019 during the military games as a test. They just didn't expect it to be so virulent and then spread. But it was meant to be released as a test. And then, of course, they let it rip and didn't tell, you know, prepare and tell people and let people travel. So if this was a bioweapon, if it was released on purpose, how do we know that this vaccine with this part made in China isn't also a bioweapon that we're now running around and giving to millions upon millions of people in America, not to mention around the world? How do we know this isn't also a bioweapon we're now actually choosing to inject in people?
So I'm glad you brought up that point, because what we were told last year was that the most lethal part of the coronavirus was the spike protein. We were told that the spike protein is what causes what's called the cytokine storm. Oh, and a cytokine is just your immune system's way of, it's like signals that they send to each other to tell your cells and your body and your organs and your systems how to react.
Right.
Well, it's what causes this overreactive.
We had Dr. Judy on explaining this in early 2020, Dr. Judy Mikovic.
Exactly. So if we know that the spike protein from SARS-CoV-2 is the bioweapon, then why would we then create the code, which is the modified RNA, you know, code, put it into a vaccine, inject it into your body, put that mRNA into a biosphere that has a positive ionizable lipid to penetrate your cells and be indestructible, and then create billions of spike protein in your body. If the spike protein's the bioweapon, then we're creating billions of bioweapons in people's body. And that's basically what's happening. And what's more alarming, if you want to go to slide 22,
okay.
I think that's a good slide to go to. Actually, before you go to slide 22, go to slide 24.
Okay, there.
So this is also from Chemical and Engineering News. It's an interview with the researchers from the NIH, NIAID, and Moderna. And on the left-hand side, you see what they have modeled through 3D modeling, the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. And what they did was they made modifications to it for purposes of injecting into into the bodies to produce the spike protein. They made modifications to it. And that's the SARS-CoV-2 post-fusion spike protein. So this is the spike protein that the mRNA is actually producing.
Wow.
After the one in the set. But if you look to the right, what I want to point out is the red part there. Those are the receptor sites that, so what this did was it changed the conformation. So they changed the shape of how the spike protein shows up in your body. So that means that the receptor sites, you know, where it's going to bind, have moved around. So and have some have changed in ways. So the red ones are the same receptor sites as the original spike protein, and then the white ones are new receptor sites, or you know, they've moved to a different point. So if you go to slide 23, and this is a publication out of Science Magazine, in the upper left corner, B. What that shows is that the spike protein produced by the vaccine compared to the original spike protein from SARS-CoV-2, it has nearly perfect the same amount of binding activity to A2 receptors. A2 receptors are in your heart, lungs, and kidneys. When it binds to the A2 receptors, that's what causes inflammation and damage to your heart, lung, and kidneys. So that matched up perfectly. What the problem is, if you go down to C, is that the monoclonal antibodies that are produced by the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, so the original SARS-CoV-2 virus produces antibodies, and when those antibodies bind to the spike protein, that stops it from binding to our heart and our kidneys and lungs, and it shuts it down. Well, those antibodies with the new spike protein from the vaccine, there's zero matching. There's zero adherence. So this does not prevent SARS-CoV-2 at all. It just creates a new disease.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So the vaccine doesn't work, but it actually creates a new disease and creates this storm inside you. And we've got this part being made in China that we don't really know what's in it. They're redacting stuff. And you're creating a whole new disease and new mutations. I mean, the whole thing, what you're saying is, in many regards, the vaccine is worse than the disease itself.
The vaccine is way worse than the disease itself. Again, SARS-CoV-2 is not that transmissible. It's very unstable. It's very fragile. It's very difficult to infect someone with a coronavirus, a single helix coronavirus, and get into their immune system, unless you put it into an indestructible biosphere and then inject it directly into someone's body. Then you have a much better chance of getting them very, very sick and killing them.
So if the bioweapon wasn't strong enough and potent enough, we'll make sure the vaccine is.
The vaccine, what it was they protected the bioweapon. The mRNA, it's very difficult to get that into someone's body. You know, they couldn't get the mRNA, and it's not that contagious. This concept of
right, but what I'm saying, if you looked at from the first scenario, if this is a bioweapon that came out of China, and it didn't really do the damage they wanted, the damage they really want is in apparently the vaccine.
Exactly. Yeah, they're like, the way we're going to really do damage and wipe out our enemies is we need to inject this directly into their body.
So the question is, if you know this, and you've just laid this out beautifully and articulately, and all the slides and all the graphics, all the research, all the footnotes, all the documentation, and you know this, does the head of the CDC, does the head of the World Health Organization, does Dr. Fauci, I mean, don't
Dr.
leading
Fauci
doctors...
absolutely knows this. He's been working on this for 30 years.
So they know that they're deliberately killing people and infecting people and harming people.
Yes. I mean, do you want to apply Hanlon's razor and say that they're stupid?
Yeah, no.
We can't attribute to malfeasance because of their stupidity.
So when Zev Zelenko came on here last night with the headline, Genocide Alert, he's absolutely right. You guys are singing from the same songbook. You just laid out a lot more detail.
It's worse than that. Go to slide 16. It's even worse than that.
Okay.
The reason why it's worse than that is because these are gene therapies, okay? By definition of the FDA, in April 2015, they put out a guidance for gene therapies. And these are virus-based gene therapy products. So what are we doing? We're injecting human beings with a synthetic virus so that it produces a virion particle known as a spike protein. And when you, what you need to do, according to the FDA, is conduct shedding studies during preclinical and clinical development. Preclinical means animal studies. They didn't complete the animal studies. They didn't do the humanized mice studies prior to going into first in human use. They did two Winster hamster studies and signed a letter of intent for rat studies. But you're supposed to figure this stuff out before you go into humans. That shedding, which according to the FDA, verbatim from their own documents, shedding means release of virus-based gene therapy products, such as a spike protein, from the patient through one of the following ways: feces, saliva, urine, nasal pharyngeal fluid, so that means it's airborne, skin, which could be pustule, sores, wounds, but it could also just be dermal contact, skin-to-skin contact. Shedding raises the possibility of transmission of these gene therapies, of these spike proteins, from treated, so injected, to uninjected people. So this Delta variant is more than likely a product of the vaccine, and now those who are vaccinated are injecting those who aren't vaccinated. They're supposed to figure this out in animal studies and then in the phase one trial. And if this happens in the phase one trial, they're supposed to figure out ways to control it through quarantining recommendations. So now we have over half of Americans injected with a vaccine, a quote unquote vaccine, a biological weapon, and they can infect others, and we don't know how to control it.
And this is why, of course, our hospitals are filling up with so many people that have been vaxxed.
Yes, they're producing spike protein. They're producing a pathogenic virus in their own bodies because they were injected with the code to do that.
My guest is Karen Kingston. You want to give your website address for us, for folks to track you down? And is this even on your website?
No. They can go to DougBillings.com. I have a tab, and you can find all the information there.
Yeah.
You want information? I'm not, yeah.
So you don't want to promote a website?
I'm not promoting anything. I guess that's not clear to people. I don't normally present my own information. I sent this information out to 30 publications and influencers and senators. And it just, you know, through God's graces and connections, I got in contact with Doug Billings, and he allowed me to start presenting the information. My purpose is to stop this and for people to, I want people to know that we were all deceived. Everyone was deceived. This was the greatest deception on mankind ever. The expression is, you know, the greatest trick the devil ever played on mankind was convincing him he didn't exist.
Right.
So what I'm hoping is that people understand that whether or not they were injected or their children, or if you're a healthcare provider, I just hope that you start looking at these documents. Don't look at the messenger. Look at the documents. Look at the evidence. Look at the people that are getting sick who are injected, and say, hey, we made a mistake. We were deceived. We're sorry we were deceived and we inflicted this harm on our own country. And we want to do whatever it takes to make things right and turn things around. That's my only intention. I just want to be clear about that.
We sure appreciate that. Let me just check with Logan here. Logan, are we monitoring Mike Lindell speaking live tonight? Do we have any ETA on that?
No, he's not up there now.
So you're going to give me the word? All right. We're still going to try to squeeze Dr. Shiva in here before we go to Mike. Let me ask you this.
I got to say, you know, as a consultant in pharma and med device and biotech, I don't think any of my clients are going to be calling me back anytime soon.
Well, so you're another American that has sacrificed money for truth and to try to save lives. Wow.
It's more than that. I know what risk I took. I almost blew a $100 million deal by accident once, and me and my family were threatened. And so I mourned a lot before I came forward, and that's what, you know, this is about America. This is about, it's about our posterity. It's about our children and our children's children and our, you know, children's grandchildren.
Absolutely. Now, yeah. I've got, the number of slides you sent me here, I've got 59, and I know you have more. So let me ask you this. Can we have you back on? Next week is our cyber symposium that Mike Lindell is hosting that we're going to be obviously covering. But could we get you back on the next week, back on TV, and go through more slides and do another hour of this? Because I know after you've been on with us, we're going to get slammed, people saying have her back on. So can we, and I know you have a ton more slides. So can we set this up for a week, you know, not next week, but the week after?
Please, and if there's a common inquiry that people have, if you give me a couple days, I can do it in one day, but a couple days notice, I can see if I appropriately answer their questions with credible resources if they have questions.
Okay. All right. Well, I feel selfish not promoting the Dickens out of a website, because normally one of the things we like to do is, you know, help people with their website and book sales or whatever to help so they can make a living. And so I always feel obligated to really promote someone's website because that's how they make their living. But
yeah, my company does marketing and business. You know, I'm an analyst for pharma and med device companies. Again, don't think my phone's going to be ringing anytime soon from Pfizer or J&J.
Wow.
So,
well, if you ever write a book or produce anything, we'll gladly promote it for you. And we're working on a documentary on a lot of this. We definitely should be talking with you about appearing in this documentary.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So, well, thank you. You've been super gracious and generous with your time, Karen. Fabulous. I love the graphics. I know we're going to get a huge response. We'll put this up as a standalone at frankspeech.com. And on my website at wvwtv.com, we'll put this up as a standalone because I know a lot of people are going to want to grab the URL and send it everywhere. And I'll be in touch with you after the symposium next week so we can get you booked back the following week to continue through more of these slides.
There is one thing I want to quote unquote plug. A lot of people have been reaching out about how to respond to their employers or their children's university. In schools. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Martin, if you go to his website, I don't know it off the top of my head, but I know you guys do. He does a brilliant rebuttal of the Texas Methodist ruling, how it lacked merit and how erroneous it was and how both the attorneys and the judge failed the American people. Within there, there is case law and there is he cites U.S. law that you can easily use to refute mandates. I'm going to dive into it myself and draft a letter that hopefully people can use, but I highly recommend if you want to know how to fight back, that letter that he wrote or that document that he wrote refuting the Texas Methodist ruling is chock full of evidence and law, and it's brilliantly written, so I recommend people take a look at that.
Excellent. Great recommendation. Thank you. Really appreciate the service to our nation and to the world, but certainly Americans. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brandon. Bye, everyone. God bless.
That's Karen checking in, and we're going to get her back. You can count on it. Wow. And the graphics and the PowerPoint make it so much easier for us lay people, right, to understand. And folks, a lot of time goes into the presentation she just put together. A lot of time. And notice how she just spills it out. She's learned it. She knows it. But just building the graphics alone, not to mention all the other personal time of study. Wow.